Well, I'd like to start by thanking Dan and Ken for the invitation to participate today. It means a lot to me, and congratulations, Bill. Best of luck in the future, but congratulations on an incredible career. What I'd like to do is talk a little bit about one of the great contributions that Bill made in an area that I work in. And it starts off with the simple fact that during the 1960s and 1970s, most people who worked with pests of forest trees made the simplifying assumption that you could understand the impact on the forest by understanding the impact of insects on individual trees. Okay? That basically, if you knew enough about how individual plants responded to defoliation, you could predict what would happen at the ecosystem level. And it turns out, of course, that that's not true. And one of the great contributions that Bill made for us was pointing out the need to consider ecosystem level processes when we consider the impacts of forest pests in forest systems. He pointed out to us, if I can grab this, that yes, it's all very well to study the dynamics of insects, but many of their effects are really only visible to us at larger spatial scales and with reference to ecosystem processes. And that was really the message of Bill's classic paper that Ken referred to, the Matson and Addy paper from 1975, in which Bill very strongly argued for an ecosystem perspective, not only to understand interactions between forest pests and plants, but also to think about how we might manage forest pests. And so, I don't know how many of you remember this paper coming out. It's the wrong direction. There's Bill in 1975 opening his copy of Science. He hasn't changed at all, which is just incredible. You can see here, it's incredible. He's just got his copy and he's opening it up there. And in fact, none of us have changed at all. This is me in 1975 with my copy of the paper. What irritates me slightly is that Bill still has most of his hair. Not quite sure how that happened. What are the key points of that paper? Why am I going to talk about it? First of all, if you read the paper, its main point is to examine the evidence for the hypothesis that insects can act as regulators of primary production and nutrient cycling. There had been some murmurs to that effect coming out, if you will, from the Odum School, the idea that insects could indeed act as regulators of primary production and moderate effects on nutrient cycling. But I think more important than that was the inherent value of moving away from short-term effects of insects on plant growth to study more long-term ecosystem-based approaches to management. And that really, for me, is the strength of the manuscript. It also made explicit for the very first time through a simulation, through a numerical simulation, the idea that forest productivity could actually increase following defoliation or tree death. And so this is the first figure from the paper, and it points out that there are lots of ways that insects and plants can interact. We're all, I think, familiar with the idea that insects have a negative effect on plants, and plants have a positive effect on insects. But one of the things that Bill pointed out in this paper was that, in fact, there's a lot more possible. And he stated that many have become so engrossed with the plus-insect, minus-plant coaction that they've ignored or dismissed any other possible relationships. Particularly if you look at the long term. And that was the simulation that was in the paper for the spruce budworm. The key one to look at here is column Y, which is the difference in stemwood biomass in the presence and absence of spruce budworm outbreaks. And it makes the very simple point that in the short term, as you follow the outbreak down with the age of the forest stand over here, if you look at column Y, the initial impacts, sure enough, are negative. But over time, the effects on forest stand biomass are positive in comparison to stands that have not been attacked. And that was really one of the very first numerical evaluations of that, and points out that if you're interested in managing forests, you need to understand potential positive effects as well as negative effects of insects on forest productivity. The thing that staggers me about this paper is the detail of the mechanistic approach that was taken within it, and its focus on indirect effects. And what I mean by that is that Bill recognized the interactions between biotic effects such as insects and the abiotic environment, including things like temperature and rainfall and the kinds of forces that operate on the forest floor after the canopy has been opened by a defoliation event. And so if you look at this forest canopy here, this is July, you can see that the forest canopy has been consumed by insects. There's a lot of light now reaching the forest floor. The temperature of that forest floor is different than it was before. So we don't have to just consider the effects of the insects on the plants. We have to consider the effects of the insects on the ecosystem as well. And those of you with good eyesight may recognize that that's Jack Schultz in 1975. So he actually had more hair back then as well. Here are some of the mechanisms that Bill mentioned in his paper, and it's actually remarkable because these are the same mechanisms that many of us are studying today. The positive one is the loss of, the direct mechanism is the loss of photosynthetically active tissue. Almost all the rest of them are indirect mechanisms. Very, very much ahead of its time. Particularly that last one, which is where a lot of research is focusing today, which is stimulating the activity of decomposer organisms. In other words, Bill was at the forefront of linking above ground and below ground processes in forest systems. Another quote from the paper, which I find particularly intriguing, talks about cybernetic systems. Again, I think this comes from the Odum school of thought, whereby we see ecosystems as linked units of feedback. And a regulator in a cybernetic system is anything that narrows the range of variation within that. And it's a product of negative feedback processes. And for me, this was a very important realization because it set me down the path of trying to link together population-level processes and ecosystem-level processes. And for me, the logical way to do that is to recognize them both as negative feedback processes and try and link models at the population level and the ecosystem level together by their joint roles in negative feedback. And we're taking some baby steps towards that. And I just want to spend a bit of time talking about the kind of work that we do as a result of the advice and foresight that Bill's work provided for us. So in a model like this, all we're essentially trying to do, it doesn't matter whether it's a verbal model or a mathematical model, is link the population processes and the ecosystem processes together. Each of these arrows represents a potential route of feedback in the system. And the first point I want to make is that if you don't actually need to link the population and ecosystem processes together to understand the system, you don't have to do it. It's a very flexible way of viewing the world. All you need to do is set some of those arrows to zero, and you can basically set the system back to a simple old ecosystem model, the kinds of things that we're used to thinking about from the Odum school. But if we then admit that population processes and ecosystem processes are linked together, we can decide which links are important for a given system. In the one shown here, for example, ecosystem level processes cascade up, if you'll excuse the oxymoron, to influence population level processes, but there is no cascade back down from the population level processes to the ecosystem level processes. It also allows us to add complexity as we need it. For example, many of us work in systems which have been invaded by organisms. And the simple point here is to show that if, for example, we have something like the hemlock woolly adelgid extirpating hemlock from eastern North America, one of its effects might be to change the size of that soil nitrogen pool. And that soil nitrogen pool in a watershed might influence stream nitrogen, and that stream nitrogen could influence predator-prey interactions, say, between fish and insects in streams. And all of that level of complexity can be added to this kind of system. We recognize the indirect effects that Bill mentioned in his paper, and we can exploit them in this kind of modeling. That's been very helpful for me as I've tried to understand the role of predators and their influence on insect-plant interactions in forests. I don't have time to talk to you today about birds, but I do have some time to think about trying to put together a model of how that might work using some of the indirect effects that Bill talked about. So in this system, we have herbivores linked, as Bill suggested, directly to the forest floor nitrogen cycle. And herbivores provide inputs of organic nitrogen into the system. Bill talked about frass inputs and orts, or bits of leaves that messy insects drop as they eat. Of course, that soil organic nitrogen is a major source for soil inorganic nitrogen during mineralization. That mineralized nitrogen, some of it at least, is then taken back up by plants, will end up in the next generation of herbivores, and of course those herbivores are food for birds. So these systems are all linked together through indirect effects in that system. So there are lots of indirect effects. Most ornithologists don't wake up in the morning thinking, I wonder what effect my birds are having on soil inorganic nitrogen, or vice versa. But in fact, those links are there, and in some cases, might be quite strong. The other thing that's important when you take indirect effects into account is that interactions can vary in sign. So for example, do herbivores, or rather do birds have a positive or negative effect on soil organic nitrogen? And the answer, of course, is yes. They can have either positive or negative effects. If you follow the link from birds to herbivores, that's a negative link. From herbivores to soil, organic nitrogen is a positive link. Positive times a negative is a negative overall effect. But if you also follow the link from birds to herbivores being negative, from herbivores to plant organic nitrogen being negative, and then back to soil organic nitrogen, negative times a negative is a positive, and so the overall effect could be positive. That's a really important point. The overall effect of birds on soil organic nitrogen could be either positive or negative. It depends on the stand that you're looking at, and it depends on the relative magnitude of the indirect effects that Bill described in that paper. But we can take models like that, either mathematical models or verbal models, and make predictions from them based on how the model works. And one of those predictions is simply that herbivores should increase the pool of inorganic nitrogen in soil. If you follow the blue arrows first, herbivores increase soil organic nitrogen. That's the FRAS and ORCHs that Bill talked about. Those, of course, are the source of soil inorganic nitrogen, and that's a positive effect. However, herbivores also eat plants, and plants eat inorganic nitrogen, and negative times a negative is a positive. Either way you cut it, herbivores should increase pools of soil inorganic nitrogen. Another prediction you can make is that the nitrogen in herbivore feces should be recycled back to herbivores. That's fairly straightforward. You can follow can't see the color of the arrows from here. I think they're red positive arrows through that system. And you can see the feedback cycle in that. That's not perhaps terribly interesting. Perhaps what's more interesting is how strong is the effect and how fast does it happen? And I want to talk a bit about that. Let's do the first one. Herbivores should increase the pool of inorganic nitrogen in soil. I tried to put together a list of mechanisms by which this could happen, and of course what I ended up doing was recreating the list of mechanisms that Bill had written about in his 1975 paper, with a couple of slightly odd additions, like salival messengers at the bottom that we didn't know about back in 1975. Other than that, Bill pretty much had all of this covered 30 years ago. I don't have time to talk about all the work we're doing on those, just a couple of them today, feces and the chemistry of throughfall. This work is done at the Coweta Hydrologic Laboratory in North Carolina. And one of the reasons to work there is they have a history of outbreaks that appear to result in changes in nitrogen dynamics. So fall cankerworm outbreaks at Coweta are associated with increased nitrate export in streams, and we wanted to investigate that. Now, one of the things we know is this is not insect frass or foliage falling directly into the stream, because the measurements that you make in the stream, the increases in nitrate, happen 2 or 3 months after the defoliation event. So this is something that's happening in the soil, and at the watershed scale is then ending up in the water. So this is a graduate student of mine, Kitty Reynolds. She is spooning insect frass into a wayboat there to do some experiments. I'll describe one of those experiments in just a minute. Into every PhD, a little serendipity must fall, and halfway through Kitty's thesis, we had a serendipitous outbreak of a sawfly in the genus Periclista. It was extremely helpful, and it basically did exactly what Bill had described. It opened the canopy up and increased rates of decomposition on the forest floor. Kitty, my student, had already put a lot of traps out in Coweta to measure frass fall, and so was able to exploit this natural outbreak. She was making these kinds of measurements before the outbreak started, and during the outbreak, and after it. This is what the forest floor at Coweta looks like, and there's our sampling regime. You can cover those laundry baskets for 24 hours in plastic to measure frass fall. You can measure litter fall, and the funnel measures throughfall precipitation that's coming through the canopy. First result is kind of obvious. The pink bars are the watersheds that were defoliated. The blue bars are the undefoliated watersheds. What I hope you can see from that is that we're more frass deposited during the outbreak in May in areas that were defoliated. Well, that's not exactly rocket science. That's empirical evidence that shit happens. That's all that is. Okay. But a more important question is, if shit happens, what happens to shit? And one answer is at least part of it turns up in soil nitrate. Okay. So about 6 weeks after the defoliation event, we start to see a spike in soil nitrate in those watersheds that were defoliated by Periclista. And you can see that there. Not only that, But a couple of months after that, during the fall and winter rains, we start to see it showing up in the streams as well. Here's some data for winter stream samples for 96, 97. The year of the outbreak was 98. And I hope you can see the spike in stream nitrate that resulted from this particular outbreak. What I've shown you so far isn't anything more than correlation, so we wanted to do some experiments to tie this down, particularly since a good friend of mine, Gary Lovett, has suggested that most of the nitrogen released by insects should be rapidly immobilized by decomposers and actually not available for export. So we wanted to take a look at that. We did a manipulative experiment. We manipulated quite a lot of things, frass and throughfall and litter and greenfall. Again, I'm only going to talk about frass and throughfall. The following slides are a little bit difficult to see, but hopefully you can see the major result that happened. And what we found were blooms of fungal feeding organisms in the soil. So Calendula populations in July and August, following our additions of frass in May, we started to see increases in Calendula populations. Calendula, of course, in the system are primarily fungal feeders. And so the assumption is, yes, indeed, the fungi are starting to immobilize the nitrogen in the frass, but it's being remobilized by grazing. If that's true, we ought to see the same thing with other fungal feeders, and indeed we did. Here are fungal feeding nematodes responding both to frass and frass and throughfall throughout the experiment, both at low elevation and high elevation. So the bottom line really is that following defoliation at Kaweda, we have the frass fall in spring, rapid microbial immobilization, presumably by fungi, we suspect remobilization by grazing, and some nitrate then available in soil and some loss to stream export. We've repeated that experiment several times in the field and also in tree microcosms, mesocosm experiments. I'll show an example in a second, and we found the same results. So this seems to be robust. The frass provides a source of inorganic nitrate in the soil, so we can put a tick beside our first prediction. That one seems to hold true. Second is perhaps less pleasant to think about, the idea that feces comes back to haunt us sooner or later, at least it does for insect herbivores. To look at this question, another graduate student of mine, Chris Frost, again working partly at Kaweta, but in order to study this, he wanted to do something quite experimental using stable isotopes. It's quite hard to do that at the forest scale at Kaweta, and so we cheated, and we did this one in mesocosm. And so the experiment I'm going to talk about here was done in this kind of mesocosm. So if this is Kaweta here, this is mini Kaweta, which is our perfect replica of the large one. Chris Frost, who built this, called this the Red Oak Mini Ecosystem. I called it a tree in a pot. But he called it Red Oak Mini Ecosystem because the acronym is ROME, and there was so much work involved, he said ROME wasn't built in a day. Okay, so that's why he called it this. But we did use Kaweta litter and soil for the experiments and imposed an N15 tracer experiment. Here's what we did. First thing we did, we took a group of trees and inoculated them with N15 ammonium nitrate to the soil. We then added herbivores to those trees so that we could collect their frass. Then we threw those trees away. Okay, we don't want those trees anymore. We don't want those caterpillars anymore. The only thing we want is the frass. So we now have the labeled frass. We add that to a second group of trees, and then we monitor where the N15 goes. Does it stay in the soil? Does it leach out? Does it end up in the foliage? And if so, does it end up back in herbivores? If so, how much and how fast? So that's the basis of the experiment. So here's our frass factory. These trees have been loaded up with N15 ammonium nitrate. We add caterpillars to that. They turn it rapidly into frass. We collect the frass. Now, we had a stupid idea about this point. And the stupid idea was that perhaps if the trees were damaged, they would go foraging for their own frass. Okay? Imagine you're a tree in a forest. You recognize you've been eaten. Perhaps that would send signals through the plant that they should go foraging for frass. So we wanted to see whether damaged plants picked up more N15 from their frass than undamaged plants. That was the crazy idea. It didn't work. Let me tell you that straight off. It didn't work. We thought it was an interesting idea. But there is a damage treatment imposed on this, which you need to know about to interpret the graphs that follow. So H is for herbivore damage. M is mechanical damage. U is undamaged. R is reference trees. Whenever you're doing an N15 study or any kind of stable isotope study, you need a reference tree which tells you what the stable isotopes would be in the absence of enrichment. And so we add the N15 frass to all but those reference trees, then collected soils, collected leachate, and monitored what happened to the foliage. Into every PhD thesis, and so on with the serendipity. In this case, it was a nice little outbreak of Anisota. It wasn't on our trees, thankfully. That would not have been good, but it was close enough that we could grab them and use them for an experiment that we hadn't thought about before. So we brought these Anisota back to the laboratory, starved them for 48 hours to void their guts, fed them leaves from damaged trees and the reference trees, and starved them again to void their guts, but this time we collected their bodies and we collected their frass. And this is where things got exciting. At the top here, you can see the uptake of N15 into the trees. Those are the various mechanically damaged and herbivore trees and so on up there. This flat line at the bottom is the reference tree. That's a good thing. It means that our reference trees were uncontaminated by our isotope signal. You can see that these plants are taking up N15. Now this is, look at the dates along the bottom here. This is running from May through October. This is where the damage and frass was applied. And so just a matter of weeks after damage and frass application, we're starting to see an N15 signal in those leaves. Remember, the only source of that N15 is frass from the previous generation of herbivores, right? And this is during a period where I suspect we're going to hear about shortly, nitrogen in foliage is actually going down. Okay? So if you actually measure the overall nitrogen in the foliage, the foliage is actually decreasing in nitrogen content. Despite that fact, it's taking up N15 from insect frass. Not only that, but when we submitted the bodies and frass of this late season herbivore for isotope analysis, they had become enriched. In other words, you have early season herbivores feeding on trees and forests. The frass falls to the forest floor. Not only do the trees get that nitrogen back within a season, but it ends up back in the bodies of late season insect herbivores that feed on those trees. A remarkably rapid rate of nutrient cycling that's going on in forests. So to answer the question that Bill asked in 1975 with that paper with Mattson and Addy, are insects regulating nitrogen cycles in forests? I don't know if they're regulating the cycles, but there's absolutely no question that the nitrogen is cycling within that system within the period of a single growing season. So we can say that certainly it's recycled back to herbivores. So I want to tell you a little bit about what's coming next. To be perfectly honest, we're not that creative in my lab. So essentially what we're doing is we're kind of working our way down Bill's list from 1975. We are looking at some of the weirder things like salival messengers, and we've looked at most of these at this point, but currently underway, we're starting to look at effects of root mortality on nutrient cycling. So herbivore-imposed root mortality, herbivore-imposed root exudation, and Chris Frost has recently published some of that work. We're also looking at how the replacement of species and genotypes in systems that respond dramatically to chronic and long-term herbivory, how that influences nutrient cycling and productivity. So basically what we're doing is working our way down through that list that Bill gave us 30 years ago. So that's the value of that particular paper. It spawned essentially a research program that I've been very lucky to be part of for the last few years. It's taught me and my lab group a fair amount about how insects and nutrient cycles interact in forest systems. For Bill, keep up the positive outlook. Keep that. You've had a positive outlook for years. We've all admired it, and I know that whatever comes, you'll keep that positive, optimistic view of the world. With that, I'll be happy to answer any questions that you have. Thank you.
Okay. Got plenty of time. Could you repeat any questions?
Sure.
Thank you.
Okay.
So then this re-raises the question, why are so many herbivores, early season herbivores, is there not some opportunities now for late season herbivory that we don't quite understand?
So Ken's question was, so if there are all these opportunities of recycled nitrogen for late season herbivores, why don't we see more of it? And I think perhaps one of the answers to that is that nitrogen is only one of the factors that insects care about. It's interesting to me that at least in some of the oak forests in Europe, many of the ones who are late season feeders tend to be have larger head capsules and larger mouth parts, and perhaps able to deal with tougher leaves. They're often, in fact, bivoltine as well. So many of the late season feeders in European forests have a late season generation and may exploit some of that recycled nitrogen. But then they also have an early season generation as well. So if you remember Paul Feeney's graph from 1970 with the two peaks of herbivore species richness, many of the ones involved in that second peak are also members of that first peak, and that was something that we didn't realize until a few years ago. So I actually think they're exploiting both. But I think water and toughness still provide perhaps some limitations to that. Is that me done?
Yeah.
Thanks.
Okay, thank you very much, Mark.